Okay, now we can start.
Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA.
If you build it, they will come. Joel, seen that movie? He's in the movie, Joe.
Hosts Jordan Malley and Matt Peck dive into the best Bulls news and stories around the NBA.
In our 670 of the Score studios, Jordan Malley.
Shout out to Jordan Malley.
Did Matt Peck get a signed copy of that book?
No, Matt Peck, he didn't. No.
No.
Talk to D. Rose.
Yeah, he's going to make it happen.
Matt, you will be getting your book soon.
Kick back and get ready for the best hour of your day.
Are players buying in, Jim?
Yes.
Fair enough.
And so all I was saying on this podcast, the Locked On Bulls podcast.
Locked On Bulls, 5 days a week.
Locked On Bulls starts now.
You can just see the vibe.
Here are your hosts, Jordan Malley and Matt Peck.
What's up and welcome into Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. I'm Jordan Malley. Along with me is Matt Peck. Follow us on Twitter at Jordan C. Malley, at Bulls underscore Peck, and at Locked On Bulls. Hit us up on our text and voicemail line, 331-979-1369. Drop your texts, your voicemails, anything you got for us, 331-979-1369. And I'm betting that there's a lot of thoughts out there right now, whether it still be lingering things on Bulls free agency, Bulls GM moves, Bulls front office moves, whatever the case may be. But I think the more pressing issue is what we saw last night, Matt. And how are you? And were you just as satisfied with the first two episodes of The Last Dance as I was?
Yeah. What's up, Jordan? What's up, Bulls Nation? I obviously had huge expectations, still have huge expectations for the remainder of these, eight episodes we have left after last night. I will say this as my only complaint about the first two episodes we saw last night. I wished there was more of that quote unquote locked in a vault, never before seen footage stuff that we kept hearing about as they were talking up this doc. The NBA entertainment was granted insane, unprecedented access to follow the Bulls around all season long. And wait till you get a load of this stuff. We saw some of it. I personally saw some footage I had never seen before, like a small portion of the Bulls practice where MJ is like barking at Harper and barking at Tony. We saw a lot of footage from their exhibition trip to Paris to play that game leading into the 97-98 season, including some locker room stuff on that trip, some fun stuff on the bench with Harper and Scotty Burrell and MJ clowning around. So, like, we got some behind-the-scenes footage in the first two episodes. We also got a lot of amazing old footage of, like, a young MJ biking around Chapel Hill and a young Scotty just destroying souls and backboards at Central Arkansas. That was one of my favorite parts of the first 2 hours, was watching Scotty's college highlight reel. It was amazing. But I hope that in the next episodes, we get more of that behind-the-scenes drama that we were billed. Other than that, though, like, that's my only complaint. I loved it. I fucking loved it.
I will agree with you on that. And I was just thinking it to myself. I didn't really say it to anybody. But I thought the same exact thing, and I thought the moments where we did capture some of those never before seen moments, they were very, very short and they were very quick. You brought up a couple of examples. How about the example too, while they were in France, MJ and David Stern having a conversation like right outside the locker room, the training room, before the season starts. So little things like that. And my favorite one, and I don't know if this was known before, but after they won that, they won the trophy in overseas in France, and MJ comes back to the locker room and says this.
They're going to Inverno Center.
Get out of here.
They're going to Inverno Center?
No. Phil, keep it. Don't let Jerry get it.
What?
All right.
One
of you guys who never won before, welcome to being a champion. That's a good start.
I thought that was great. Welcome to being a champion. And then also, too, don't let Jerry Krause have the trophy that they had just won. That's MJ being petty at his finest.
I mean, and that was one of so many examples we saw already in the first two episodes. Clearly, the first two episodes, I think the director's goal was, okay, a quick rehashing of how did we get here? You know, you had like the vintage moments from each of the first five title seasons, kind of like montage spliced together. And then it was, let's set up the Jerry Krause versus the Bulls players and coach story. And then here's, you know, MJ early life autobiography. And then episode two, you know, half of the episode is Scotty early life autobiography. And then Scotty's problem with the front office. So much of it right out of the gate was Jerry Krause versus MJ, Phil, and the rest. And I knew that that's going to be a big part of this documentary, because you can't tell the story of that 97-98 team without Jerry Krause being a very big factor. And hearing things like, you know, everybody's been throwing around that quote, you know, saying to Phil, I don't care if you go 82-0, like, you're fucking done. This is your last season. And Phil basically being like, okay. And then I like that when Phil said, so I said, okay. And that was all we said of it. But clearly there has to be some kind of like telling from all sides. At least that's what I wanted. I didn't want this to just be a bash on Jerry Krause documentary, because I do think that there's plenty of blame to go around. And it is too bad that, you know, we got some sound bites from Jerry, like from that, you know, obviously much long ago interview where he was highlighting the different, you know, omission of a word when MJ quoted him about players, you know, don't win championships, organizations win championships. And Jerry said, well, you know, he misquoted me. I said players don't win championships alone, and he omitted the word alone. So in that sense, you got some of Jerry's side, but like, you know, RIP, the dude passed away, you know, a year or two ago now. And he's like not here to defend himself. And as much as it's funny to listen to MJ and the guys poke fun at Jerry, you know, MJ crack a joke, say, oh, those pills, you know, those pills that keep you short, or those the diet pills, or when he's asking Jerry, hey, you want to join the layup line with us?
Right.
Like, it's funny, but it's also mean and cruel.
Quote that was attributed to you.
Well, as you know, David, there was a misquote. What I said was that players and coaches alone don't win championships, that organizations do. I do sincerely believe that organizations as a whole win. One part of it can't win alone. The guy left the word alone out of there.
Right.
And he admitted it later on. Oh, yeah, I left the word out. Well, you dumb son. That's what killed the quote.
You left alone out of there. I miss hearing stuff like that, like very, very authentic Chicago. But you're right, Matt. Oh, yeah. That was my... So I had a list of questions as somebody that doesn't remember growing up in this era. Obviously, I was alive, but I was 1 to 7 years old. So I was hoping that maybe I could get a little bit more insight from you, and maybe you had some questions about things that maybe some people for the first time are seeing how our reaction was. So hopefully we can weave the next 25 minutes or so like that for our listeners out there who experienced all of this, and then for fans who didn't experience this and we're just seeing this for the first time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was going to say, like, thinking back on, I remember this season because I remember as a kid thinking, because that's what we heard. And you saw that soundbite from Krause, too, like standing outside the Birdo Center with a media scrum around him saying, this will be Phil's last season. Like, could you imagine if something like that was said in today's world of social media? Like, oh, my God, Twitter would explode. You got, you know, a team that's won 5 titles in 7 years, the greatest coach in the game, the greatest player in the game. And here's your, you know, short little portly GM who's got a Napoleon complex. And it, you know, rubs a lot of people the wrong way, standing in front of a huge media scrum saying, you know, my word is God, and this is Phil's last year. Period. End of sentence. End of debate. End of discussion. That's crazy to me. So even as a kid, I was aware, like, this is the last dance. This might be the last time we see Michael Jordan playing basketball for the Bulls. This might be our last chance to experience winning a championship with this group of players. So there was so much weighted on it. And I remember thinking as a kid, oh, man, like, this is the last season, the last title run they're going to go for. And Scotty's out like the first 40 games of the season with an injury that appeared to come out of nowhere. And, you know, I was a naive kid. I was like, wait, Scotty's having surgery on a foot? Like, what the heck? What's he been doing for the last few months? Of course, knowing now that Scotty, everything was calculated. And Scotty purposefully stuck it to the organization he was disgruntled and underpaid and sick of front office, you know, drama, and thought, you know what? I can postpone this surgery, enjoy my summer. That's what he said, right? I didn't want to fuck up my summer. It was so good. And, you know, just stick it to him. All right, good luck without me. And the Bulls struggled out of the gate at the start of that season without Scotty. And while he's sitting on the bench, he's requesting a trade again. That's another thing that I kind of forgot about. Because everybody remembers when Scotty was unhappy with the Bulls while MJ was playing golf or playing baseball and like requesting a trade on the sidelines All-Star weekend. And then again, that like the Bulls and Sonics almost pulled off a Scotty for Kemp trade that didn't happen before a 95-96 season. But the one that I kind of forget about is in November of 97, while he's recovering from that foot surgery, he requested a trade again. Crazy.
It is crazy to think about that. I do have some questions about the way Scottie Pippen carried himself and the some of the explanations that he gave. And I'm curious about how other Bulls fans feel, and I want to ask you these questions. But I want to circle back to Krause again really fast. I did have a sense of kind of feeling bad for the guy. You know, you see these clips of him getting made fun of and seemingly just getting picked on and scrutinized left and right. And, it brings me to modern day and comparing it to how kind of the way in which people criticized the Bulls front office here and the way that kind of the Bulls front office ran. Man, it was almost like a mirror image, the way that I saw like secret meetings with Tim Floyd on the heels of Phil Jackson leaving and, you know, little things keeping guys out of the loop and nobody saying anything. This reminds me exactly like Fred Hoiberg. Exactly.
Right.
And when did Gar join the organization? 1998. So I'm curious if a lot of these guys picked up on any of that.
You see all those similarities of how this organization operates. And you just said, you know, the phrase like nobody's saying anything. And it got to a point where like things were so contentious and they were so in danger of losing Phil that Jerry Reinsdorf had to intervene and say, all right, Krause, like go sit in the corner, take a timeout. I'll talk to Phil. I'll smooth things over. And the Bulls came to an agreement with Phil to pay him $6 million for that final year with the understanding that it would be his final year because Krause wanted him out and he wanted to rebuild. There is that same lingering issue. The through line for this organization since Jerry Reinsdorf bought it in the mid-'80s is they preach communication and have terrible communication. Like, you know, the backstabbing, the spying, the what's going on, the egos, the power struggles. And it's so funny to me that, you know, we saw Paxson a number of times already in the first couple episodes as he's being interviewed and also footage of him playing in the games. Especially, dude, shout out to that 70s porn stash of John Paxson from that Bulls-Celtics playoff series of 86, right. Man. Oh, my God. I can't believe he actually had that thing on his face. It was so nasty. But the other, you know, the through line of talking about Bulls head coach Stan Albeck saying to MJ, I'm so sorry, man. I'm so sorry. I'd love to play you. I'd love to let you finish this game. But a strict 7 minutes, a half limit, 14 minutes a game. If I play you a second more, they will fire me. And it's just like, gee, what was that thing that John Paxson and Vinny Del Negro came to blows about, you know, like 10 years ago? There are so many similarities and through lines of management and coaches, management and players not getting along, and Reinsdorf ownership just going, I didn't see nothing. Carry on. It, you know, like the latest example is Paxson going to Michael and saying, hey, man, I don't know if you're watching this, but this is a disaster, and you need to let me fire myself. They're so hands-off, which should usually be a good thing. Let the people who know what they're doing do their jobs. Sometimes it's a bad thing. And Scotty's contract is one great example of that. Scotty was at fault. Krause was at fault. The Reinsdorfs were at fault because they shouldn't have let it get that far.
The thing that pissed me off about Reinsdorf, and maybe this is just a good way of the way the documentary kind of is trying to portray organizational power, And so I felt like Reinsdorf in this documentary for the first two episodes was kind of pictured a little bit on the evil side, I guess, if you want to even call it evil. To me, it was like Reinsdorf first was going to allow Jerry Krause to just basically tank away the 85 season and not let MJ come back and not let him try to win, do any of that. And they were trying to tank for a draft pick. And MJ's like, fuck that. I don't want to do that. I'm here to win. And yeah. So that caught me off guard a little bit. And I was like, wow, that goes all the way back to the 80s of like them trying to manipulate what's going on the floor. And then the other thing was Jerry Reinsdorf at the time. And look, this isn't all Jerry Reinsdorf's fault. And he told Scotty. He told him, don't sign the contract. You're going to regret it. You're going to regret signing this extension. But I was trying to tell multiple people this, too, and arguing, like, what is Scotty supposed to do in that situation in 91? You're getting dangled $18 million out in front of you. Your family desperately needs to get taken care of. You want to take care of people right now in the immediate future. And I get he was probably making a decent chunk of money at the time compared to the rest of the people. But I mean, $200,000 compared to $18 million is generational type of wealth immediately. So it put Scottie Pippen in a bad position. It was like Reinsdorf's like, well, here's a contract, $18 million for, you know, for five more years. And it's not a good contract, though. Don't sign it. Don't sign it. I think you get a lot more money for it. But remember, if you get hurt, it all goes away. So it's like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And then as Scottie kind of progressed throughout his career, he got bitter. I think he got bitter, and maybe that plays into the role of always having to be second fiddle to MJ.
Yeah, I mean, second fiddle, maybe. And you certainly saw Scottie flourish in that 93-94 season when MJ left, people thought the Bulls weren't even going to make the playoffs. And Scottie led him to 55 fucking wins as a near MVP. Like, he got edged out by Hakeem, who I think, you know, probably rightly won it that year, but you could make an argument for Scottie. That's insane. You lose the greatest player in the game and you still win 55 behind Scottie's amazingly brilliant season. He's always been underappreciated. Robin to MJ's Batman has never been an accurate description. It's disrespectful because, as MJ has constantly said time and again, and MJ doesn't dole out praise all that often, none of this happens without Scottie. None of it. And look, there are a few factors here. To me, it's hard to see it unfold the way it did, because was Scottie underpaid? Yeah. At the beginning of that contract he signed, 7 years, $18 million. It was actually a pretty solid deal for the first year or two as far as compensation versus production. And he was only making like not even $500,000 less than MJ at the start of that contract. But it was 7 years. And in the time of that contract's existence, the NBA got a new TV deal and a shit ton of money, and contracts exploded. So that's how you have a disgruntled Scottie in the 97-98 season entering year seven of that contract, and he's got $2 million and change as the sixth highest paid player on his own team, the 122nd highest paid player in the league, and he's a Hall of Famer. An all-defensive team, all-NBA player, going for his sixth title. And MJ, meanwhile, because of the Bulls being allowed to sign, you know, retain, like, players that are on their roster, free agent, and then become free agents, they can sign them whatever they want and, you know, go into the luxury tax. But they signed MJ to $33 million that year, his second straight one-year deal worth upwards of $30 million. And so when you look at it that way and say, okay, let's all take a second to realize just how ridiculous that was, because the salary cap that season was like $3 million less than that. It was like $29 million and change. And MJ's salary alone was 33. So that makes Scottie's $2 million and change look insultingly low. But it was like, you know, Dennis was making four. Tony was making 3.5 or 4. You know, I think Luke Longley maybe was also among the players who made more than Scottie that year. So it's like, yeah, he had a right to be upset. And yes, he was underpaid. But as you said, Jerry told him not to sign it. He said, if you sign this, I'm not renegotiating. And Scottie got bad advice, I think, from his agent, who was one of the most trusted and respected agents in the game at that time. And you have to take Scotty's upbringing and personal life into account. His dad had had a stroke and was in a wheelchair. His brother, one of his 12 fucking siblings, got into an accident like wrestling and was put into and was paralyzed. He's got so many family members to worry about providing for. And he took the security of a deal right then and there. Hey, it's spread out and it's not that much, but I know I'm getting paid over the next 7 years, and $18 million should probably handle me taking care of my family for the rest of everybody's life. So he made the choice. My other thing is, and this is something that Casey Johnson brought up in a column earlier today, the Bulls did do right by Scotty eventually. When they orchestrated that sign and trade with the Rockets in 99 after the lockout, they got him an extra $30 million by doing that sign and trade. And then also gave him an extra $10 million for 20-some games when he came back and played that final year before he retired. So, like, yeah, everyone was at fault. And Scotty took the money up front and then got pissed about it. And then they made him whole at the end. Thankfully, he never got traded, and the Bulls won 6 titles. The one thing that I come back to and have an issue with is Reinsdorf and the refusal to renegotiate. I get that you don't want to open that can of worms to other players. Well, he got more money. You know, let me get more money. But come on, man. Make an exception for Scotty freaking Pippen, which goes back to my original point. This dude is no scrub. He's no Robin to a Batman. He is a legit Hall of Famer, named as one of the 50 greatest players of all time. If that dude is grossly underpaid, and we are all aware of that in the present, Jerry Reinsdorf, fix it. And he didn't.
The one thing, too, is Pippen's wife tweeted out last night, is like, Scotty did all right, guys. Don't worry about it. He had a cash earning throughout his career of over $102 million. So he found other ways to get paid. It was just the fact that you're not getting paid to do the one most important thing in your life right now, and that's play basketball and win championships for the Chicago Bulls. And Matt, that was the other right thing that pissed me off so much, was Reinsdorf saying in that clip, he was like, I told Scotty, you walk out that door and you sign this contract, you're not walking back in here renegotiating. It's not happening. And he held to that. Reinsdorf held to that. No matter what, no matter how deep the criticism got, he was like, you're not renegotiating a contract. And I can understand it, man. I get it from both sides. But like you said, the idea that you were just willing to stick to your guns here when you had the two greatest players of a generation playing on your same team, and everybody is literally screaming at you, don't break this team up. Don't break this team up. Man, I listened to Tim Floyd make a comment, I don't know when it was, a couple weeks ago, and he said, even when I was interviewing for the job at the time, I told them, don't break this team up. Don't force MJ away. Let it die by itself. Let it die naturally. And I found that interesting, and maybe that's just Tim Floyd saying things after the fact. But regardless, everybody was telling Krause and Reinsdorf, let this die naturally. Do the right thing. And yet they felt like they couldn't wait to allow MJ to leave and see what the Bulls would be post Michael Jordan and the success that they would have. And look at where we are right now in 2020, still after the aftermath of the dynasty. We're in a place where we're not anywhere near success. So I think that's a lot of has come back to bite the Bulls and come back to bite Reinsdorf. And that's part of like the criticism towards Krause and Reinsdorf. But look, Matt, and this is what maybe you can fill me in a little bit and some other younger listeners. The way that Scotty's portrayed in this, I feel like, to me, he was a little bit selfish. And not a little bit, maybe a lot at that end. You know, MJ talked about it twice. He was like, I don't think Scotty was being fair when he requested the trade. I think Scotty was being selfish when he decided to have surgery right at the beginning of the season and not do it during the summer. He's like, I get why he did that, but he screwed the rest of us over. He made it 5 times as hard for all of us to try to win, and it wasn't a team mentality anymore. It was me versus everybody else. And for a lot of me, and I understand why Pippen was so pissed off and so frustrated, but the idea that you're sitting next to the to your partner, a guy that you just won five championships with, and you're going to piss all of this away to basically be on your own agenda just kind of puzzled me. But maybe that comes back to Matt, is Scotty's like, I sacrificed so much for this team, and I'm playing number two. I could be a star on any other team. I could be that number one guy. But I've sacrificed a lot, and now I'm asking for a little bit of a repayment, and I'm not getting it from anybody. I can understand why that would piss him off.
Yeah, of course. I mean, he was underpaid. I mean, plain and simple, yes, he was underpaid. And I think, you know, just like every element of this documentary and every element of this final season, there's plenty of blame to go around for why it ended. And as one specific of one of the problems, there's plenty of blame to go around for Scotty's contract problem. Partly him signing that deal. And it was risk versus reward. And guess what? He was dealing with an injury at the time of signing that contract in 91. And he had already kind of had some back issues. And he was worried. And he had a family to think about and to provide for. And he took the guaranteed money instead of risking it and saying, well, if I bet on myself and maybe take something shorter, I can get a new contract and really get paid. But he didn't. He took the sure thing. And I'm guessing he was probably as upset with himself for doing that as he was upset at Jerry Krause or Jerry Reinsdorf or anybody else.
It's a good point.
You know, it's human nature. It's you make a decision, you weigh the pros and cons, you weigh the risk factors, and you do the best thing that you think is the best thing in that moment. And Scotty took long-term security, and he grossly outplayed the value of that contract over a span of years where he was the second best player. And even saying second best player is disrespectful because it makes it seem like he was by far off the second best player when he was damn near close to being as good as MJ on the greatest dynasty the league has ever seen. So yeah, he was underpaid. He got made whole at the end. He made plenty of money. It's just a shame that that was such a focal point and such a frustration and perhaps a contributing factor to this team being dismantled, as you said. And MJ said it too in the, you know, I think we should be allowed to defend what we have until we lose it, referring to the rebuild versus go back again. And if Phil's still there, then MJ's coming back. And if MJ's coming back, then Scotty and Dennis are coming back, and they get the whole gang back together. However, I don't think you can hang all that on Krause. Phil has said you get 6, maybe 7 years as a voice, as a head coach before a team tunes you out. That was year 9. Okay. Jerry Krause said, I don't care if you go 82-0, this is your last year. You know what Phil Jackson said? Cool. I think Phil Jackson was ready to be done too. Scotty was getting old. His back was giving him problems throughout that playoff run in 98. Dennis was getting old. He was breaking down. Luke Longley was getting old and breaking down. There were so many elements to that team breaking up. And yeah, you wonder what could have been. And it's something that I thought about a lot as I was watching that documentary when MJ said, like, we have a right to defend it. I have always thought it was such a perfect ending. It was a fairy tale ending. You know, Jordan scores the last, you know, 4 points in 30 some seconds and a steal in between. It's iconic. It's an iconic finish to the greatest NBA career ever. And maybe you mess that up if you get greedy and try another one in 98-99. And maybe instead of 6-0, immaculate in the finals, MJ's 6-1. Maybe they don't get back to the finals. Because I looked at that 7-game series against the Pacers in the conference finals in 98 and said, holy crap, we barely escaped by the skin of our teeth on that one. I also thought they might lose the finals in 98 to Utah. They maybe should have. So I didn't think it was a sure thing. All those factors, I did not think it was a sure thing. But then you think about the passing of the torch and all the iconic teams leading up to the Bulls dynasty, like the Celtics finally passing the torch to the Pistons, who finally got past them in the Eastern Conference Finals. And then the Lakers finally passing the torch to the Pistons after the Pistons choked against the Lakers the first time round in the finals. And then the Lakers and Pistons passing a torch to the Bulls. Like, it was such a big part of the glory of the 80s and 90s NBA. And the Bulls didn't do that part. The dynasty ended just because people couldn't get along. And that is kind of a bummer.
The last thing that I wanted to talk about from these two episodes, more of on a side story basis, but I found it very, very fascinating. I'm sure we will hear more throughout the next eight episodes. But Michael Jordan's first real exposure to what it was like to party in the 90s or the 80s and the 90s in the NBA, and his real first exposure to the amount of drugs that were going on, the amount of partying that was going on, I thought was absolutely fascinating. I wanted to replay that really quick.
I came from a program in college. It was about team game. You know, it was a clean program. It prepared me to go into a Chicago situation, which was totally different.
Before Michael Jordan got to the Bulls in 1984, drugs were prevalent, cocaine and recreational drugs of all types. So he had a lot of partiers.
One of the articles I read, they called the Bulls Traveling Cocaine Circus.
I never read that article.
Accurate?
Look, guys were doing things that I didn't see. I had one event, preseason, I think we were in Peoria. It's in a hotel. So I'm trying to find my teammates. So I start knocking on doors. I get to this one door, and I knock on the door, and I can hear someone says, shh, someone's outside. And then you hear this deep voice says, who is it? I says, MJ. And then they all say, oh, he's just a rookie. Don't worry about it. So they open up the door. I walk in, and practically the whole team was in there. And it was like things I've never seen in my life, you know, as a young kid. You got your lines over here. You got your weed smokers over here. You got your women over here. So the first thing I said, look, man, you know, I'm out, you know, because all I can think about is if they come and raid this place right about now, I am just as guilty as everybody else that's in this room. And from that point on, you know, I was more or less on my own.
His townhouse was just a regular place. And at the start, his mom would be there an awful lot. And Jordan's buddies would come by, you know, players and what have you. But he was just living like he's still in college.
I enjoyed, you know, just hanging out, playing cards, watching movies. You know, I wasn't going to the clubs.
Whatever somebody else might have been doing off the court, if it was partying, whatever, that wasn't part of what he wanted to do. Orange juice and 7-Up was his go-to.
I don't smoke. I don't do lines. I didn't drink at the time. I was looking just get some rest, get up, and go play.
I love that at the end. Get some rest, get up, go play. That was his mentality. But Matt, that story, and then MJ laughing when he said the Bulls were called a traveling cocaine circus, I thought was hilarious. But I mean, that is just a sliver, like a crack into the window of what it was like to be on one of these teams traveling around in the 80s or the 90s. It's just the amount of exposure these guys had to partying and drugs. And it was crazy. Like, think about where MJ's career could have turned if he was decided to stay in that room and been like, you know what, fuck it, let's do it. I've never been a part of this. I never had that experience in college. Screw it, let's try it. And things could have gone dramatically different.
Yeah, and you know, thankfully and not surprisingly, MJ's competitive desire walked him right out of that room. You know, I'm not gonna sit here and judge NBA players for partying. You know, without going into any specifics, I've always lived my life by the motto of something that my mom told me her dad used to say to her, my grandfather, who I never met. He passed away before I was born. Don't knock it till you try it. I've tried a lot of things in my life. These NBA players who were partying it up in the 80s. Hey, man, do what you want to do. You're a grown ass man. Do what you want to do. But there's also what we know has been said about that era, and like that the NBA needed Larry Bird and Magic Johnson to save the league from such an irreputable image of drinking and drugs and women. And, you know, just like it was not a well-respected league because of that stuff. And it was partly just the era. Everybody was doing drugs in the 80s. The country was great, economy booming, and everybody was just like, hey, yeah, let's party. NBA players, no exception. But it also brought tragedy. Think about Len Baez, man. Like,
right.
That is something that I think doesn't get thought about enough, is when you talk about tragedy, you know, we're just now trying to get over the loss of the tragic loss of Kobe Bryant. Obviously, you know, passed away for different reasons. But Len Baez was about to go join an already nasty Celtics team. Lottery pick in the draft. Amazing talent. Everybody said, sky's the limit for this kid. And he ODs on draft night? I mean, of course Michael walked out of that room. Of course he did.
I think for a lot of Bulls fans, like you had said, I think you put it best, is, you know, for the idea of the NBA, too, for him to walk out of that room and just consistently stay to that plan of, I'm not getting myself involved in this. I have a greater picture. I have a greater goal. And for a lot of it, too, I even think about, like, guys after MJ, you know, started the turn of the century, and Kobe started to take over, and all of these other guys started to come in. You know, that Kobe mentality, too, was taken on. Obviously, Kobe seemed to party a little bit more than maybe MJ did, and maybe in different ways, but still, that mentality.
When he was young, like MJ, you hear stories, like Kobe would be a hermit away from his teammates. He didn't party with his teammate. He wasn't even old enough to go to the clubs.
Right.
You know, so,
right.
You know, in Kobe's case, going to the NBA. But yeah, like he just did what MJ did. He was like, just going to work on my game.
And I had heard, I was listening to an interview with Melissa Isaacson, and she had covered the team back then. And she said, like, I don't think younger fans truly understand that Kobe literally based his entire life off of the way MJ carried himself and modeled himself after that way. Like, it, outside of the basketball stuff, it was he had a plan and basically used Jordan as a blueprint. And I think people are going to start to understand that more and more as they watch this documentary. So I'm curious to see that too. But Matt, yeah, that was just one part, and I'm sure it's going to play a more prevalent role as we start to talk about other players across this Bulls team in the last dance. And that's the other most important thing we can leave it here, is I think people are starting to get the realization this isn't just a Jordan documentary. This is a documentary about this entire team. So that's why we got a whole episode on Scotty. We got a whole episode on the background of Jordan. We're going to get one on Rodman next week. And we're going to start to hear. We're going to probably get one on Phil Jackson. We're going to start to hear about other players and their roles. And I really, really appreciate that about the way that this documentary is kind of portraying things, is it's not just solely, it may feel like it's solely based on Jordan, but there's a lot of other elements that went into this. Jordan was just obviously the star of all of it.
Right. Yeah. I think you just put it perfectly. There were so many interesting storylines to that dynasty, and especially that final season. Power struggles, egos, coaching players, front office, and ownership across the board. But Jordan was always at the core of it. That was a great team. And six titles, and especially a specific focus on this final title season, is a great topic for a documentary. Why? Because Jordan's at the core of it. That team was great because Jordan was great. And that's, I think, the thing that I am just so continuing to be excited about, is just more of Jordan's greatness. It's a team that was great, but it was great because of MJ. And this is the last thing I want to say. And it's something that my buddy Kamka, who's a great stat guy over at NBC Sports Chicago, pointed out on Twitter last night. We watched the highlights of that 63-point performance at the Boston Garden as part of the first two episodes last night. MJ was, what, I think 22, 23 years old, coming into a playoff where the Bulls were an 8 seed at 30-52. And that was all, you know, like MJ, as we were talking earlier, wanted to make the playoffs, to hell with the draft lottery. I don't give a shit about ping pong balls. And there was even that one regular season game where Stan Albeck didn't let MJ in for the final play. John Paxson hits like a miracle random shot to give the Bulls a regular season win they needed to get into the playoffs. So, like, he's still shaking off Russ a little bit, had still been on this, like, 14 minutes a game minutes restriction in the regular season. And then they go to Boston for two playoff games against the best team in the East, the best team in the league, and arguably, as many would say, one of the best NBA teams of all time, the 86 Celtics. One of the best NBA teams of all time. That team had five Hall of Famers on it. Five. Obviously Bird, McHale, and Parrish, but also Johnson and Walton. And MJ dropped 49 on him in game one. Didn't get the win, but dropped 49 on him. And, you know, Johnson was like a defensive player of the year guy. He was a perennial defensive, you know, all defensive first team guy. And he was getting cooked by Jordan. Driving Luke Walton crazy. I loved even, like, poor little Rick Carlisle got a shout out on that doc for getting cooked by MJ.
Carlisle wants his mommy.
Carlisle. Amazing. Amazing. And then the next night, he dropped 63 on you. In a time when MJ, the three-point line was there. He didn't use it. Rarely people used it. He scored 63 points in a playoff game on the road against a five Hall of Fame player team, one of the greatest teams of all time. And he dropped 63 without shooting any threes, man.
It's crazy.
That is insane.
It's absurd. It is absolutely absurd. Something we'll never see again. I can guarantee you that. Well, we will never see somebody drop back-to-back nights points-wise and not attempt the three, not make a three. That is absolutely crazy. And I don't know, Matt, is this the first time we heard Bird say, like, word for word, that night or that series, I felt like God was disguised as MJ?
We ended up winning the series, but it was an incredible, incredible playoff performance. I've never seen it before, and I had never seen it after. That wasn't Michael Jordan out there. It was God disguised as Michael Jordan.
That's, I love that. It gives me goosebumps because it's true. It's so true the way that you watched MJ play. And like you said, five fucking Hall of Famers on that Celtics team, and he was able to go out there and basically give them every ounce he had, and it took every ounce of the Celtics to beat them in that series. And you could hear Larry the way he talked about him too. It was just madness, absolutely madness. And I am so pumped for the eight other episodes on this, Matt. And the last thing too is ESPN released the numbers from last night of the watching, and it broke the record for the most watched documentary by ESPN ever. 6.1 million people were watching last night, the first two episodes of the documentary series. So that breaks a record for ESPN. And I'm sure once the full 10 parts are out, because I know it's paired with Netflix as well, that this will go up on Netflix, right. And I can only imagine what the streaming numbers are going to be on it too.
Oh, they'll be insane. But yeah, I was not at all surprised to hear that. I mean, of course it was going to break the ESPN documentary ratings record, because we are all in a time where, like, you know, it's just, you know, MJ wins, man. It's MJ's doc. MJ had the final say on when this was going to go and how it was going to be done. And he gets to release his documentary to remind everyone, including all of you D-Rose stands out there and your LeBron stands and all your, oh man, you know, Kevin Durant this and Steph Curry that. MJ is the GOAT. And he just released a documentary about his greatness while everyone is quarantined during a global pandemic. If that isn't a GOAT move, I don't know what is.
I saw a tweet too that said he signed the release docs for all of these, all this unreleased footage from MJ the night that the Cavs won the finals. Is that, I don't know if that is accurate, but I saw multiple people tweet that out and from people that have verifications. So if that is true, that is just, that's another classic MJ move, is I got to pull this out while LeBron's at the top. Got to remind people.
You know, like MJ rarely talks about the, you know, greatest of all time stuff. And he always refers to the greats that he respected, you know, Bird and Magic and trying to earn their respect. Dr. J, you know, Russell, Kareem. And that he felt especially even after the first three-peat, like, I got nothing left to prove. I wanted to prove that I could hang with these guys and I could win and not just win scoring titles, but win championships. And I did that. And he hasn't had to, at any point in his retired life, say, hey, remember me? I'm Michael Jordan. Because he is a living legend. He is a global icon and a living god in the sport of basketball. And he will always have people arguing his goatness for him. He doesn't have to do shit to keep his legacy intact. But maybe recently there's been a lot of talk around certain people and certain names of quickly dismissing MJ and even other people on the list for this dude named LeBron, who we obviously don't want to get into all of that right now. And LeBron's career has been very impressive. But there is only one Michael Jordan. There will ever only be one Michael Jordan. And there have become a new generation of NBA fans who needed to shut up and learn that. That's what this documentary is going to do.
With that, I think that's going to about do it here on Locked On Bulls. Thanks again for listening, guys. I know you guys are probably just as excited as we are to watch the rest of the eight parts here. But if you want to pitch in any of your thoughts, your comments, just anything that you felt through the first two episodes of this series, we're going to get to all of those on Wednesday's episode of Locked On Bulls. So drop your voicemails and your text messages, 331-979-1369. On Twitter as well, at Locked On Bulls, at Jordan C. Malley, and at Bulls_Peck. We got Chuck Swirsky tomorrow. First time we're going to talk to Chuck Swirsky on the podcast. Very excited to talk to him, even about some of this. He was working in media at the time, so I'm very curious to ask him some questions about this. But also, we kind of just want to tap into his career overall. Chuck has had such a long and historied career, not only in sports, but here in Chicago as well. So very, very excited to talk to Chuck. But yeah, that's going to about do it here on Locked On Bulls. For Matt Peck, I'm Jordan Malley. Bulls Nation, have a wonderful day. Be back tomorrow with a fresh episode. For Jordan and Matt, we are out. Deuces.
Locked On Bulls, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA. Hosts Jordan Malley and Matt Peck dive into the best Bulls news and stories around the NBA. For more content and to stay up to date, head over to LockedOnBulls.com